This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, November 19th, 2012. I'm Caleb Brown. Economic expansion in recent years has meant growing income inequality, according to Brink Lindsey, author of the new ebook Human Capitalism. But it isn't inevitable that the skills necessary to thrive in this new world will be shared as unequally as they are. Brink Lindsey is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. We spoke about his book last week.
So the basic gist here is to explore the connection between economic development and cognitive development. And the dynamic works like this. The richer and more advanced our economy becomes, the more complex our world becomes. And therefore, the more participating in this complex world imposes heavy mental demands on us, which we have responded to over the course of the last 100 years or so by investing in human capital, by developing all kinds of skills and specifically mental capabilities that people didn't need before and consequently didn't develop before.
You make a note that despite this big increase in the college wage premium, that is the value of a college degree relative to not having one, that the growth of young people getting college degrees, that has slowed considerably. And so you ask the question, why aren't people responding to the economic incentives? And your conclusion is that the problem is cultural.
Yeah, it's a puzzle. Back in 1980, the average college grad made about 30% more than the average high school grad. Over the course of the 80s, that college premium went up to about 70%, so more than doubled, and has stayed high ever since. Why? It's basic supply and demand. The demand for highly skilled workers keeps going up over time as our economy gets more complex, but the supply has stalled. The relative growth of college grads since 1980 is about half that of what it was from the 60s through 1980. And in particular, all the growth that we've seen in college graduation since 1980 has been among women. The male college graduation rate has been completely flat since 1980. So why is that? Why aren't people responding to incentives? And I argue in the book that a main reason lies in culture. That is, there are systematic differences in upbringing, both from the family and from larger community influences, between the children of college-educated white-collar professionals and the children of the working class or the underclass, on the other hand.
Now, how does that interact with the changes in family structure? How does that interact with changes in sort of the racial component of college graduates?
Yeah, so we've always had class-based differences in culture and in human capital development. It makes sense that if your economy needs large numbers of people to do just sort of brute labor, that those people aren't going to develop a culture that prizes and focuses on intellectual stimulation and long-range planning, because working-class people don't have careers. They have one job after another that don't really lead in a career kind of direction. So all of the kinds of things, all the kinds of skills that go with being a white-collar, college-educated professional aren't useful if you know you're going to be born and live in the working class. And until relatively recently, most people had low-skilled jobs because that's the economy was at a low enough state that there wasn't demand for more high-skilled workers. As that has changed, we've seen a lag as the culture of the working class has proved persistent, and people there just aren't being inculcated with the skills that they need to take advantage of the greater opportunities that are currently present. In particular, we've seen a kind of cultural polarization. Once upon a time, family life in America was kind of the same across class lines. Everybody had this basic laissez-faire kind of parenting style where the basic idea was you keep your kids clothed, housed, and fed and keep them from getting hit by a bus. And otherwise, all the other kind of development is just going to take care of itself, particularly intellectual development. You look at parenting books before the 1960s, they're all about health of the kids. They're nothing about increasing their brain power or making them smart. So this turn amongst more educated parents towards really stressing cognitive development and developing the skills you need to get ahead in life is of relatively recent vintage. And so at the top end of the social spectrum, we've seen this big focus on what the sociologist Annette Leroux calls concerted cultivation. College-educated parents are spending much more time with their kids, and the family structure in well-educated homes has actually gotten more stable. Divorce rates since the 70s have plummeted in that demographic. Meanwhile, you've seen completely the opposite happen for everybody else. Divorce rates went way up in the 60s and 70s and have stayed high and even gone up a little bit more. There's been an explosion in the single motherhood rate, so that now 41% of all American babies are born to single moms. So you've had the two different cultures going in opposite directions. At the top end, a doubling down on parental attention and on family stability, whereas on the other side, more family dissolution, making the environment for human capital development in that group less favorable than it was before.
Now, Charles Murray talks about similar issues. That is, he seems to lay the blame, a lot of the blame, on this bubble in the value of a bachelor's degree. He seems to suggest that, well, look, we've all decided that we need to get our kids through college, but a lot of the BAs that are handed out today simply don't confer a clear set of skills that are valuable in the world today.
That's right. And I think that's true, that the marginal college grad today probably is less skilled than the marginal college grad of a generation ago. But I fundamentally disagree with Charles Murray's diagnosis and of the problem. Like me, in his book, Coming Apart, he identifies the same set of symptoms, this class-based cleavage where the well-educated are thriving and doing well and everybody else not so well. So in terms of describing symptoms, I think he's right on. His diagnosis, though, is moral decline. He identifies these founding virtues of work and faith and family. And sees that the 60s came along, the moral and cultural revolution of that time swept through society and basically ruined everything. Somehow or another, the rich and well-educated are doing great and doing fine, but according to Murray, they've hived themselves off in gated communities. They're refusing to, as he puts it, preach what they practice. They're not judgmental enough. They're not hectoring everybody else enough to do as they do. Meanwhile, the rest of society has fallen prey to the 60s moral revolution and has lost its work ethic, lost the commitment to family, and also lost religiosity, in his view. I don't think that's right at all. I think it's true that there's huge changes in the culture in the 60s and 70s. I wrote a book about it, The Age of Abundance, and I think they do have something to do with what's going on. But it's not moral decline because if you look at the people who have most absorbed the kind of relativistic situational ethics that came along in the 60s, it's the Bobo white-collar professionals in blue states who are absolute paragons of bourgeois morality. They're very well educated. They have white-collar jobs. They stick together. They marry and stay married. They do all the right things. So it doesn't seem to me that morality is the problem. The problem is skills. Once you shift away from a society where ethical norms are enforced by ostracism and shaming and kind of external authority and external influences, and you shift more to what we have now, this much more individualized, relativistic, conscience-based kind of morality where we're not going to tell you what to do. You have to figure it out for yourself. Upper middle class, college-educated people have from birth been instilled in these skills of deferred gratification, long time horizons, don't grab the donut now because you'll get two later, whereas all of that kind of long-range thinking is not a skill that is stressed in working class and underclass culture. And so what we've seen with a huge expansion in cultural freedom since the 60s, folks who have developed those skills to manage the trade-offs between their future selves' interests and their current desires and impulses. Those people are doing fine. The people without those skills have run into a lot of problems, and you've seen a lot of social issues and personal behavior dysfunctions happen as a result. What I think, though, is this isn't a moral issue. It's a skill issue.
So savers, essentially, are the people who are performing better. And there's some research, as you point out, that points to that. You're talking – to also talk about income inequality as an issue, and you're less concerned about the income inequality between yourself and somebody who makes $100 million a year than you are with the inequality between yourself and some of the other people that you're talking about, this people who have been, in some respects, you argue, left behind. So what is your diagnosis here?
The issue of income inequality has many different dimensions, and the one that seems to get the most attention is this whole issue of the 1% versus the 99%, how the people at the very top of the income scale have been soaring ahead of everybody else. That doesn't really disturb me at all. The fact that the 99.9th percentile is pulling away from the 90th percentile, the fact that the insanely rich are pulling away from the merely affluent, I just don't care at all. And as you just mentioned, the difference between me and a hedge fund manager who makes thousands of times more than I do doesn't strike me as very interesting. He makes a lot more money, but in terms of the things that really count in life, of having interesting, stimulating work and a chance to develop your capabilities and exercise them and enjoy that, get the status and self-respect that comes from that, the hedge fund manager and I are on the same playing field. If you compare me, though, to a telemarketer making a fifth of what I make, the income disparity is much less, but I think the life disparity is huge in terms, again, of stimulating, challenging, and rewarding work, and that's what really matters, I think. So the real disparity that counts is the one not between the 1% and the 99%, but between basically the 30% and the 70%, the highly skilled and everybody else. And roughly 30%, that's the number of people who have college degrees, and that's a decent proxy for the highly skilled group of people I'm talking about.
So with respect to the people who are without college degrees and to, at least according to current evidence, have a decreasing ability to develop themselves, take advantage of their desires long term to develop their own skills, have rewarding
yes.
work, as you point out. What can we say to these people?
We've seen a slowdown in human capital development. The high school graduation rate today is lower than it was in 1970. As we mentioned, the college graduation rate, the rate of growth has slowed down and it stopped altogether for men. So the demand for skills keeps going up, but the supply has stalled. The main social institution we have for developing human capital are our schools, and particularly K through 12, and they have failed manifestly to do what they're supposed to do. And the whole promise of public schooling was equality of opportunity. We don't care what your background is. You come here, we're going to give you the skills you need to thrive. That promise is being systematically broken now. So as far as how to make things better, I think first and foremost reform of K through 12 schooling is at the top of any agenda. Let me mention that in terms of the kind of growing divide between the 30% and the 70%, we've talked about cultural polarization, but there's also been an economic polarization that's going on that's highlighted this issue. There's always been class-based differences, but they used to be muddied by the existence of a big kind of mid-skill level in the occupational structure. Very highly skilled blue-collar jobs and routine clerical jobs for white-collar. And so the people at the top of the blue-collar scale and the people at the bottom of the white-collar scale were basically equal in income. There wasn't that big a difference in terms of a college premium back in the 60s and 70s. And so the incentives to break out of the culture in which you were raised and move into a different kind of culture were much less. And so those incentives have sharpened now because we've seen a kind of hollowing out of the occupational structure. Through much of the 20th century, the the change in the kinds of jobs people did was fairly consistent. We had a general upskilling of the labor force, where the fastest growing jobs were the highest skilled jobs, and the slowest growing jobs were the lowest skilled jobs, and middle was in the middle. So we had an overall shift towards higher skill levels. In the last 20 years or so, though, we've seen kind of a hollowing out in the middle as these routine clerical jobs and administrative jobs, and also more highly skilled blue-collar jobs, have either been automated and turned over to robots or computers, or they've been offshored to globalized production facilities in low-wage countries. And so we see continued robust growth in high-skilled jobs and also in the lowest-skilled jobs, and not so much in the middle. And that then has meant that the upper echelons of blue-collar achievement have been kind of knocked out. And so therefore the opportunity cost of staying in the working-class culture have gone up. Culture hasn't responded to that. We haven't seen the kind of cultural evolution to catch up with social realities, I think in part because of these family structure problems that we talked about before. So cultural polarization has made it harder for people to adapt to economic polarization. Okay. And again, what do we do about it? As I said, the central social institutions for developing human capital are our schools at present, instead of mitigating class-based differences that come from the home and community, our public schools simply perpetuate them. Kids come into kindergarten today with clear class-based differences in test scores and school readiness. Then those differentials just grow from K through 12. They don't narrow at all. What we need, I believe, is a huge infusion of competition and entrepreneurship into the educational sector. And if that kind of radical restructuring took place, we have, I think, decent hopes of coming up with new approaches that will allow these achievement gaps to be closed. We already see evidence from high-quality charter schools that these achievement gaps can be closed, but we don't currently have an institutional environment where those star schools can grow and be replicated and be copied, and terrible schools can shut down.
Brink Lindsay is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can get his new ebook, Human Capitalism, at Amazon.com, and you can read his other works at cato.org.